This is from the Midwest City Free Baptist Church.
We will be in the book of Leviticus. Just kidding. Because the people who have been coming know what book we're in, at least for a little while longer. As long as you can stand it and as long as I can stand it, we will stick with it. And it's been a little heavy at times. I'm not apologizing for that, by the way, and I never, ever will. However, I'm just saying that I acknowledge it. That's all. I'm just saying that I recognize it. We've had some tough sledding here. But it's not me. It's not me. I didn't write the text. I'm just teaching it, preaching it, proclaiming it, explaining it, and all those things that you're supposed to do, that we're sure that we are called to do together. So it's the writer. However, that being said, we'll be a little more practical today. I appreciate some of the good feedback I've had. I sometimes wonder, we had a couple of back-to-backs in here in Hebrews where they were very theological. I mean, it was pretty solid, right? But I wonder, you know, is this okay? People handle this? Again, that doesn't mean I'm going to change it. I'm going to teach what comes. I just wonder still. But I appreciate it. Some people have said, hey, this is good. We like this. This is, you know, we want the steak. Well, that pertains to where we are now. This will be more practical because we're backing up just a little to get to a section here. Let's read it and let's talk about it. Hebrews chapter 5, starting in verse 11, it'll go into chapter 6. And here's what he says, almost just right in the middle of that law, all that stuff he was saying about the priesthood, you know, all that doctrinal stuff we were doing about the priesthood. Right in the middle of it, he almost kind of stops for a minute, breaks his train of thought, and he says this. About this, we have much to say, and it is hard to explain. Since you have become dull of hearing, for though by this time you ought to be teachers, you need someone to teach you again the basic principles of the oracles of God. You need milk, not solid food, for everyone who lives on milk is unskilled in the word of righteousness, since he is a child. But solid food is for the mature, for those who have their powers of discernment trained by constant practice to distinguish good from evil. Therefore, let us leave the elementary doctrine of Christ and go on to maturity, not laying again a foundation of repentance from dead works and of faith toward God, and of instruction about washings and the laying out of hands and the resurrection of the dead and eternal judgment. And this we will do if God permits. So says the word of God. And yes, I did stop short of that super controversial and difficult passage. Because I only have time for so many headaches in 1 week. We'll get to it. So, now, there is a bizarre thing. A very bizarre thing. Today. And you'll pardon me for bringing it to light, but I do have a point here. And it has sort of a long name that psychologists give it, but its friendlier name, no less strange, but its friendlier name is adult baby syndrome. It also goes by paraphilic infantilism. And while that photo is sort of meant to make you laugh, this is a weird thing, and yeah, it's a thing, and it's really no laughing matter. It is what you might think it is. Not a Halloween costume party, but some kind of psychological disordered desire for certain people, and probably not and very few people, but still, people to self-infantilize, to, you know, for whatever reason, to live and role-play like they're infants. So, I'll read to you from the New York Post some years ago, somebody trying to introduce this phenomenon to the reading public. And the article about this said, "No image," the writer says, "captures the regressive ethos in America better than that of the 30-year-old Stanley Thornton Jr., a self-proclaimed adult baby. Profiled on a recent National Geographic reality TV show, naturally, he claims to suffer from a bizarre infantilism that leads him to wear diapers, lounge around in an oversized crib, and seek constant coddling." So, it says that this gentleman here, Thornton Jr., came to Washington's attention this week. This is, again, years ago. When the GOP Senator Tom Coburn, you will no doubt be familiar with him, challenged the Social Security Administration to probe into how the baby bottle guzzling 350-pound man qualified for federal disability benefits. A former security guard, Thornton is handy enough to have crafted his own wooden high chair and playpen. I'm guessing that they have, like, you know, bigger weight limits than the usual ones. He can drive a car. Most babies can't do that. And he has sense enough not to go out in public in his double XL footy pajamas. But welfare administrators nevertheless treat him as an incurable dependent. And after collecting taxpayer-subsidized paychecks, his adult roommate, a former nurse, has indulged his baby role-playing for the past decade. All right. Now, you're saying, yeah, thanks for nothing. I didn't come here to hear about this. Well, let me back it off a little. Let me dial down the weirdness for you. Because maybe that's... It will sort of make my point, but something less crazy can maybe also make the point here. So, less bizarre and maybe more known to you and more easily recognizable to you is the phenomenon, the more common phenomenon, of somebody who grows to full adulthood but fails to sort of take on the maturity and responsibility that, you know, is usually supposed to go with it. And so here you have a lot of psychologists and sociologists talking about a thing that they sometimes call, quote, extended adolescence. Extended adolescence, right? And so a current senator wrote a book on this a few years ago. He was a former university president, actually. Ben Sass, former university. So his time in the university showed him more about this. He wrote this book called The Vanishing American Adult on this, Our Coming of Age Crisis. And according to Sass, he thinks that our society has created what he calls an endless, perpetual adolescence, where he says a whole lot of adults sort of want to be like Peter Pan, you know, living in that Neverland. They're technically adults by years, but they still kind of can be kids all the time. He says this is a problem, and if we think about it, we would know that this would... If this is a thing, then this is a problem, right? This could really present a problem. Or a problem for society, a problem for the individuals who were sort of trapped in it when the reality kind of smacks them on the back of their heads someday. And a problem for the society that may be raising people like this, and a society, or a problem, I might say, obviously for the church. If it is so, it's certainly a problem because, I mean, after all, if, you know, adolescence itself was, I mean, in history, it's a relatively recent phenomenon. There was a time not that long ago, some generations you go back, you would find that they wouldn't recognize so much what adolescence is. It would be like, you're a child, now you're grown up, and you cross that border real fast. It'd be like when Paul says, I was a child, I thought like a child, behaved like a child, and then became a man. You know, a lot of cultures to this day have these kind of rites of passage that they do, and you're familiar with this, right? And they undergo some kind of thing, and the boy gets a certain age. It's boys, especially, are often in these cultures emphasized in this sort of rites of passage. I got to undergo a bunch of stuff. But if and when the time comes and the day comes and they do it, it's like, yeah, you're a man now. Now you're a man. And just like that, it's just like, I woke up this morning a boy, and I will go to bed a man? Well, super for me, huh? Isn't that great? I'm a man now. It's not always what it's cracked up to be. Because now you're stuck with all those responsibilities that you didn't realize you'd be stuck with. And now you go to bed with many burdens you didn't wake up with. But and so even in that book, Sass says that adolescence, he says, in some ways is a gift that culture began to give people. To say, look, how about we give you a little buffer zone? How about we give you a little bit of warm-up time? You know what I mean? Where you can start to get your feet wet in all of the cool stuff that you... all the benefits of adulthood, sort of the freedoms, you know, without yet all the burdens and responsibilities. That was the idea. But then what happened is that small category, that buffer zone, started to grow like a monster. And then it just got pushed up on into the 20s. And who knows, for some people, it's crossed into the 30s. You know, and that could be a problem. Well, so I said a minute ago, this passage differs from the ones we did the last few weeks. It certainly does. Because those were very decidedly theological in their nature, and this one is very practical. It's almost as if, as I mentioned, he's in the middle of explaining these things, and they're not easy to explain, and they're not necessarily easy to understand. And he's going back into the Old Covenant and the law, and he's talking about Aaron, and then the Levites, and the priesthood, and how it was instituted, and who served the priesthood, and he had a high priest, and how Christ is a fulfillment. It's doctrinally weighty. But then it's like he kind of goes, okay, he takes a breath and interrupts that to say, now, let me just pause here to mention to you, the people he's writing to, that this is not easy for me to convey to you, but the reason it's not easy is not so much because I'm not so good at it, it's because you aren't so good at receiving it. I mean, this is difficult, he says, and hard to explain, since what? You have really become kind of hard of hearing when it comes to... You don't take this stuff in very well. You can't process this very well because this is really solid food. This is a real, you know, big steak. You've got to chew it on it a lot. And your teeth are a little underdeveloped. You know, you're not ready for it. You should be. So in a way, he's pausing in the middle of this to offer them what you could call a kind of timely chastisement or an admonition, or let's face it, at least it's a mild rebuke, isn't it? That he's offering to them. So let's just get practical here. I've said a lot of times, and I will say it many more times in the future, that the Word does not change, but the world does change, and we're supposed to know both of them. You're supposed to know both. You're supposed to know the Word, and it has timeless features and timeless factors and principles that never do change. But the world in which you live, it does change. The Word doesn't, but the times, they are changing. Remember David's men, and you had those men I mentioned of Issachar who knew the times? That's what we're supposed to be. You should know the times. You should know your times. And so, what about our times? What would we know? What features, what relevant, salient, specific kind of obstacles and challenges do we face that would characterize our times? There's no doubt about it, I think we'd all agree, that what we're describing, what he's rebuking here, is definitely one thing that characterizes our times. If there's one thing that's sort of common these days, it is that there are a whole lot of people in our society, too many, who are, frankly, just unwise. They're just kind of foolish because they don't think much. They don't think well. They're lazy up here, and they're just sloppy. They mostly just sort of think in very brief segments and small sound bites, and they don't think beyond the limits. The character limits of a tweet. That's just too much energy to think that far past. And so they think mostly just in knee-jerk style. They think with their feelings. And a lot of times this leads them to be intellectually dishonest in many ways. I mean, this is just a problem we have. Now, am I diagnosing a problem in the church here? Or specifically? Or I mean, am I diagnosing a problem in the cultural overall? And of course the answer is yes I am, because of course I mean, who would deny it? You live in the world, right? I mean, you're plugged in, you watch what's going on, you interact with people, you are enough on social media and pay attention enough to know that this is real, this is a problem. There is an infantilization that's happening where everyone's... Grown people are very adolescent these days. Very adolescent. Their response to things is just childish. Have you noticed this? Among a lot of grown people, the way they converse with each other, the way they live, the decisions that they make, how they deal with disappointment and disagreement, it just doesn't exactly reek of stable and sane and sound thinking wisdom, does it? There's a lot of tantrums thrown today. There's a lot of overreaction and emotionalism and the inability to just calmly think things through. The church is always, always in danger of mimicking the dominant culture, of just patterning ourselves, of, if you will, conforming to the pattern of the world. You'll no doubt remember how I pounded that theme down into the ground over the course of several weeks. But it's forever the case. That's why you know the Word and you know your times. You know the world. The world's always changing. So your world has some things about it that you've got to watch out, that it's not just being conforming to the pattern. That the church isn't just going along. Isn't just in the current with the current. It just looks like everyone else, prone to the same problems and mistakes. Instead of being a transformative agent that sort of stands like those big rocks in the river, you know. Those big rocks, no matter how much the volume of the water is, it just goes around it. That's what we're supposed to be like. As the society then around us today is infantilized in this way, is childish, is unwise, is foolish. Well, the church is at big risk of just copying the trend. So here we go. Here, back to our text. Here he is, and we should consider what he's saying to them. I mean, he is in a way calling them children. He's saying that they're quite immature. He's saying that they're not ready. He's basically saying, you guys have a kind of adult baby syndrome, unfortunately. You look like adults, but then spiritually, and when I'm writing these things, and when you're trying to understand these truths and live this life, suddenly you're kind of childish about it. You just don't get it. You can't handle the food I'm offering. I'm like a great chef here preparing it, but what I should have done is brought baby formula to this gig, because really that's where you're at. You shouldn't be, but you are. So some things I think we are taught from this. We'll keep it simple and give you three of them. You want a traditional sermon? I got it for you right here. 3 points. That's right out of the handbook. Thus it is written, ye shall have 3 points and a personal story / poem. Right? Isn't that how it's supposed to go? So I got 3 things for you. So Christians from this passage, it's clear. It's a presupposition here and throughout. Christians are expected to grow. You bring a baby home, do you ever say, now we'll feed him. I just hope he gets bigger than this. I mean, I hope so. What if he just stays this, you know, what if like 8 years from now he's just still this size? Boy, what are we going to do then? Can't go to school like that. Won't be able to reach anything. Poor kid, we'll take him to the amusement park. Won't be able to ride any of the rides because he's still going to be this big. I hope he grows. You never thought that. You thought, I just do my stuff I'm supposed to do. I just add food and that part will just happen. You expected that baby to grow. And you expect him to keep on and keep on. And then, for some of you, kept going beyond what you expected. You're like, wow. Keeps on going. The believers are expected to grow. He just expects this. The recipients of this letter, he's making it clear. They should be beyond where they are. I mean, could he be more clear about that? He says, some of you ought to be teachers by now. You should be teaching the other ones. You know, but here you are. You still need the basics. And why is that? I mean, what makes that happen? I mean, we could point to a lot of factors maybe. I mean, sometimes we're prone to laziness sometimes. I don't think that's always true, but we can be. I mean, that's our default, is to just, you know, path of least resistance. Not do any more work than I really have to do. And it takes some work to do this. You have to really get in there and wrestle with it and work it out and think it through. And I mean, it takes a little work. But also there, we might be up against some wrong assumptions we have in the church. We might be up against some, where they came from, I'm not exactly sure, but certain ideas where we might be tempted to think that not, maybe we don't have to. The job of becoming biblically literate and astute, that's the job of the professionals.
That's what we pay you for. That's why you go off to the seminary and get all learned up.
I'm not supposed to. Look, when I go to a movie, I pay my money and I sit down and they entertain me. I don't feel any obligation to go behind the scenes and help make that movie, right? I don't feel like if I want good movies, I better book a flight, go down there and start telling them all how to make them better. That's their deal. I just pay and I get. But that's not how the church works. You don't file into, this isn't a theater where you come and occupy your seat and the paid people put on something and you sit next to people that you never get to know that well. We were talking about that this morning. And then you leave. That's not how this works. That's an Americanized kind of consumerist and entertainment-oriented view of the church. It's, again, that's the pattern of our times. We live in a time that is very consumer-oriented and very entertainment-driven and saturated. So naturally, if we don't watch out, we'll just see the church the same way. But it's not the same way, is it? So he expects growth here. He's saying you shouldn't have just been sitting around, but maybe you thought you didn't have to. Maybe you just thought, oh, wait a minute. In other words, maybe this is news to some of these believers. Maybe they say, whoa. I'm sorry, I didn't know that was expected of me. Or in some cases, maybe some, you know, there are people, there is a tradition among evangelicals, sadly, where they almost wear ignorance as a badge. I am holier than you because I'm keeping it simple. It's the unlearned one that's closer to God. I mean, I don't know. There's still a little bit of that. It was more prominent sometimes. I'll give you a quote from Francis Schaeffer, who fought against this in his book Death in the City. He says, Schaeffer said, there is this kind of anti-intellectualism among many Christians, so that spirituality is falsely pitted against intellectual comprehension and understanding, as though they stood in tension or dichotomy, like they're enemies. But he says, this kind of thing cuts away at the very heart of the Christian message. Because what we have is the entire church is just basically the nursery. The whole church is the nursery. And how is that going to help the world? How is that going to reach across and minister the word to people and answer their challenging or difficult questions? How will that defend truth against all lies and errors and assaults against it? How will we be equipped to do that? Basically, we've just taken all of our arms and thrown them into the river and gone out and just wandered out between the lines into spiritual warfare, unarmed. Go ahead and send your army out between the trenches with zero arms and let's see how they do. So we're just sending them out to slaughter in the spiritual battle. They're not equipped. You don't take your infants and send them out like that. So the growth of believers is an expectation. It's just assumed. If you're a believer, it's not an optional thing. Well, the second point here is that the stunted Christian or infantilized Christians are partly the fault of the leaders. Partly the fault, but not completely. It would be easy to just say, well, it's the church leader's fault. And to a very large degree, it is. They're church leaders. Many church leaders are at fault. But the Bible's been clear on that. We can go through passages that are very critical of certain teachers, leaders, and shepherds, can't we? Poor shepherds and bad teachers and false teachers and corrupt leaders. There is plenty to say about that throughout the text. There is plenty to say. So we know full well that, I mean, frankly, in some circles, the state of preaching across our churches is in shambles. In shambles. There are people who spend their time reviewing and I don't know how to say this, like they're watchdogs maybe. They review the prominent, lots of big prominent leading churches and then so sometimes I read through what they say. Sometimes I'll say, so last Easter here are like 10 sermons that were at the mega large churches that have a lot of influence. And you can sort of read through what they were. And sometimes some of it's pretty bad. By the way, I didn't say the person wasn't skilled and charismatic and could speak. I'm talking content. Sometimes it's pretty bad. So yes, leaders are much at fault. There is a heavy responsibility. Remember the pastor says, some of you should, you better watch out. Your teachers, you're even more accountable because of those you influence. But you still ought to be teachers, some of you, even though it's a heavy responsibility. But see, my point here in this passage is to say, it's not only the leaders, not only the leaders who are at fault for this phenomenon. The people themselves bear some responsibility. You're supposed to take some initiative. You're supposed to be active in some way in this. So think of what he's saying to them. He's saying again, look, you can't always handle what I'm given here. But frankly, the writer seems to be implying, I'm doing my job. I'm holding up my end. I'm doing my part. I am skillfully, carefully, artfully, accurately, as clear and in clear language you all understand, trying to teach you these solid truths. So if it's not finding a place, if it's not getting home, if the seed doesn't find the right soil, it ain't the seed's fault. He's saying in this case, this one's not on my end. It takes two, you see. It's funny because he says that they're dull hearers. How about that's for a switcheroo? Huh?
Oh, my sermon's dull? Maybe the
dullness isn't on my end. Maybe the problem's not on this side. Oh, the sermon's too boring for you? Yeah, well, maybe you're boring. I'll tell you, I've felt this way in some of the classrooms I've walked into. I've been a teacher for years. Not every classroom's the same. But I've walked into some classrooms and I feel like saying, you people are boring me to tears here. I mean, you know what I mean? It's just like all comatose. Like this is so boring. I need a little help. Of course, now some preachers feel like they gotta like solicit all the help they can. Like, you know, I'm gonna need you to shout, jump around, say some stuff, affirm. Sometimes that's just traditional. But the fact is, just thank you. I heard that right on cue. The amen corner. The fact is, though, sometimes the hearers are partly at fault here. It's not just the message that's where the dullness is, where the ineffectiveness is. Sometimes, I mean, you can't just offer it. Someone has to eat it. It's like if I walked into the finest restaurant that had all the greatest food, and I said, this isn't meant for you unless it applies. But there are those many Christians who say, and if you've grown up around the church, you've heard this approximately 10,000 times. They say, well, I just wasn't being fed. Sometimes you're not, because again, sometimes there are plenty of places there's not much on the menu. There are plenty of places where it's a concession stand. They got cotton candy, and it's just not offering much. So you weren't going to get much nourishment at that concession stand that you went to. So sometimes, as I said, it's the leader's fault. But sometimes the stuff ain't bad they're serving. But you weren't being fed because you wouldn't eat it. Like I went to a nice restaurant, and can you believe I walked in there, I sat down, I opened my mouth, and they wouldn't even put any of the good stuff in it. They wouldn't come with spoons and insert the food into my mouth. Can you believe it? So I went somewhere else because I wasn't being fed at that restaurant. You get the picture? The great English Puritan and noted abolitionist John Brown said this. He said, there is no pouring of Christian truth passively into the minds of men. If men will not listen and reflect and examine the meanings of statements, the validity of arguments, the force of motives, the best possible teaching, he said, the best possible teaching will not make them any wiser or any better. It won't do any good because they won't eat it. They won't listen. They won't consider it. They won't think it over. They won't take any initiative. They somehow think that you can just walk up with a drive, insert it into the back of their head, and upload all the stuff. But that's not how that works. It takes some Listen, you want the steak? You want the big, juicy, medium, well-done steak? Or whatever your preference is? Then guess what? You've got to take it, cut it yourself, stick it in your own mouth, and chew on it. until it's done. And then swallow it and take it on in. And then you'll get whatever benefits it's giving to you. Pardon me, my apologies, vegans. Okay, blame the text. So, that's how that works. You've got to take a role. And so then my last point here, which I've really already said, but he says it. He says, this is not optional. It's not extra credit. It's not for the few, the proud. It's not just for those in the upper crust. It's not just for those very few who sort of want to go the extra mile and go all out and really, you know, add a few merit badges. It's not just, well, a few of you can be straight A people, but hey, you know, C's getting degrees. That's not how don't be like that, right? Don't be like that. He says this is important. This is vital and indispensable. To be willfully ignorant. Okay, to just say I don't want to grow, I don't really want, no, I just, school is hard, so if you could just keep me back in the fifth grade over and over and over and over and year after year after year until I'm 48 years old, but I'm still in the fifth grade, that's cool because fifth grade works so easy. I don't have to work very hard. I'll never have to worry about all that stuff like calculus, whatever that is. I'll stay in fifth grade. You laugh. But for some people, they go to church for decades and they're still in the fifth grade. They really are. And all it would take is a standardized church test. And boy, you wouldn't like the results. Have you ever seen some of the surveys? Sadly, some of these surveys get done to church people. There are people that will go stand outside of churches. I know, maybe this is wrong. I don't know. And they'll film it and they'll ask the people questions. Oh, brother. They'll ask him about their favorite verse and second hesitations or whatever, you know. You know what I'm saying. And I mean, really, third Hezekiah. And they'll get answers. People always want to pretend they know more than they do. And it's just evident that they don't know much. That they're fifth graders. And that may be an insult to fifth graders. But they're like not very advanced fifth graders. I mean, really, but that's willful. It has nothing to do with their ability and their IQ. Sometimes we got people in a church that are in the fifth grade spiritually, biblically, theologically, but they own a bank. Or they know how to do surgery on the human body. They can fly an aircraft. They can run a business. They can balance complicated sheets. I mean, whatever it is, they're not stupid. It's willful. They're saying, I just want to be a fifth grader. And so to do that, what is the result of that? He's saying that's not... The consequences of this aren't just minor. He says, this is serious. This would be dangerous for you. Dangerous for the church. And ultimately, it's dangerous for the world. In other words, there's a lot riding on it. On the development and maturity of believers, there's a lot riding on it. Right? Go, therefore, and make what? Disciples. Not converts. Converts is assumed. Okay? You're making no less than converts, but you are making more. You're making disciples. So the purpose, notice what he says the purpose of this is. In verse 14 he says, you're doing this for the sake of discernment of good and evil. Is that how he put it? So that you can discern good and evil. I don't know. Gee, does that sound kind of important? Knowing good from evil? Well, but I already know good from evil. Well, you may know the most obvious ones. You know, I mean, any child can see obvious evil. Any child can see, look, if the devil himself came walking up with horns and smoldering and reeking of sulfur and looking all red and devilish and devil-like with long fingernails and looking all hideous and heinous, then any kid would recognize, you're bad, and run away. Any kid's got that covered. You think that the enemy of mankind is that kind of a simpleton? You think he's that kind of a dupe and a dope? I'm telling you, he's a mad genius is what he is. He's the diabolos. He's diabolical. He's clever. He's not going to approach you that way. And so, can a kid recognize when they're... This is why you try to teach your kids to discernment. This is why you tell them, hey, don't go running off with that guy in the van with the candy.
But he's got candy and he looks like a nice guy. He's clean shaven.
He's real friendly. He's real clean cut. He's not, he didn't have horns. He didn't have, he's not evil looking. He's not terrifying. Yeah. Don't go near that guy's van. See, that's not how the predator does it. And the predator that we're talking about is a master predator. And he roams like a lion. He's real good at it. Discerning good and evil. That's not child's play. You better be real good at it. And if you don't know the times, you don't know how to understand what's coming your way. You can't read through all the malarkey and the hooey and the lies and the nonsense, and you can't get down to truth, and you can't think things through. You're an easy mark. You're an easy target. You're just going to walk right in to the enemy's van with the tinted windows. That's what you, and he's got you. And you'll be utterly ineffective and miserable. And the church will be inept. You ever wonder why the church just seems like it's inept? Because sometimes the church looks like it's just a big children's crusade. You familiar with the children's crusade? Back during the period when the crusades began? It's a little history lesson here. This is a weird thing, but you know, the crusades began with there was a message sent from the Eastern Christians, out the Greek-speaking Eastern Christians, and they sent a message to the West, to the Europeans. And they said to the leaders in Rome, they said, please, please help us, basically, because these swarming armies of this, with this new religion called Islam, these swarming armies have just shown up and they're just conquering all of our towns and cities, and they've overrun us and we can't beat them. And they're bringing this new religion, and they overtook Jerusalem even. And so now they occupy the Holy Land, and they're persecuting the Christians, and they're besmirching the holy sites and the shrines and the places. And it's really terrible, and please come help us. So all these medieval European knights decided, it's our duty to go fight off these infidels who have... And that's how this started. And so some of these knights had money and means and arms and, you know... But that, these were the, quote, crusaders. They went to do this, and it led to these wars. But there were some other crusades that happened that weren't quite as glamorous and glorious, because some people took it upon themselves to kind of go off half-cocked and just head out. And there was one group, reportedly, of these young people, just, you know, fire in their eyes, ready to, what's the guy used to say, to storm hell with a water pistol, right? They're just ready to take off and go get her done themselves. But they were young, like adolescent. There were some teenagers that led them, and then they had some younger people than that. And they all just said, let's head out and go. And the story was that they all were going to make their journey themselves. But they weren't ready for the world. They weren't ready for life, leaving the confines of your safety, of your kingdoms and castles, and going out there to the unknown world. And they were slaughtered. And sometimes the church looks like a children's crusade. A ragtag bunch of people who aren't ready, heading out into the world, and they just get clobbered. And I see them all the time out in the culture. You ever see Christians interviewed or out in public discussions and debates? And you say, oh boy, oh man, ooh, that was ugly. They weren't ready for it. Somebody put a microphone in front of them, and they became the representatives for Christian belief, and it didn't go well. They weren't prepared for that. They weren't ready for that. And there's all kinds of ways we may not be ready. And so in some ways, this kind of ignorance can be as bad as malice. Now, I want to read you a quote from a man you may be familiar with, who was a great theologian in his own right, and an admirable person, of course, who stood against the Nazis and led an underground church and Christian movement, and ultimately was killed in a death camp. He refused to be rescued by his friends when they said they'd get him out because he wanted to stay with the Christians inside the camp and the suffering Jews and other people. And he says, and he has this quote, Dietrich Bonhoeffer does. I mean, and you may even disagree with him. You may think he's being too harsh. But in his letters and papers from prison, one section, he says, Bonhoeffer says, stupidity is a more dangerous enemy of the good than malice. One may protest against evil, and evil can be exposed and, if need be, prevented by the use of force. Evil always carries within itself the germ of its own subversion, in that it leaves behind in human beings at least a sense of unease. And he's saying, like, at least there's a conscience in people that kind of lets them know, this is kind of wrong. But against stupidity, we are defenseless. And he goes on to say, not on the screen, he says, neither protests or the use of force can even accomplish anything here. Reasons will just fall on deaf ears. People will just refuse to listen. And in all of this, he says, the person who's practicing stupidity, in contrast to the malicious one, is often utterly self-satisfied. He doesn't realize. His conscience doesn't bother him. Because he's just going along, taking her easy. There can be real trouble if the church and if the society as a whole decides to become a bunch of adult babies. If we just self-infantilize and we say, you know, the meat's kind of hard chewing. So when the writer of this text is giving people the kind of beef stew that we've been eating up on the last couple of weeks, and you go, wow, that's hard. That's some real theology. Those are some big questions. Just know that he's doing us a service. The chef has prepared good, solid nourishment for us. All I'm doing is serving it up. He's prepared it. This isn't my meal, but I know my job is to give it to you and to serve it up the way it was cooked up.